11. He turned right, then stopped, turned, and retraced his steps to the corner. He needed to walk down 2nd Avenue now, yes, that was unquestionably correct, but this was the wrong side again. When the light changed, he hurried across the street and turned right again. That feeling, that sense of whiteness, rightness, grew steadily stronger. He felt half mad with joy and relief. He was going to be okay. This time there was no mistake. He felt sure that he would soon begin to see people he recognized, as he had recognized the fat lady and the pretzel vendor, and they would be doing things he remembered in advance. Instead, he came to the bookstore. 12. The Manhattan Restaurant of the Mind, the sign painted in the window read. Jake went to the door. There was a chalkboard hung there. It looked like the kind you saw on the wall in diners and lunchrooms. Today's specials. From Florida, fresh broiled John D. McDonald. Hardcovers, 3 for $2.50. Paperbacks, 9 for $5. From Mississippi, pan-fried William Faulkner. Hardcovers, market price. Vintage library paperbacks, 75 cents each. From California, hard-boiled Raymond Chandler. Hardcovers, market price. Paperbacks, 7 for $5. Feed your need to read. Jake went in, aware that he had for the first time in 3 weeks opened a door without hoping madly to find another world on the other side. A bell jingled overhead. The mild, spicy smell of old books hit him, and the smell was somehow like coming home. The restaurant motif continued inside. Although the walls were lined with shelves of books, a fountain-style counter bisected the room. On Jake's side of the counter were a number of small tables with wire-backed malt shop chairs. Each table had been arranged to display the day's specials. Travis McGee novels by John D. McDonald, Philip Marlowe novels by Raymond Chandler, Snopes novels by William Faulkner. A small sign on the Faulkner table said, "Some rare first eds available. Please ask." Another sign, this one on the counter, read simply, "Browse." A couple of customers were doing just that. They sat at the counter, drinking coffee and reading. Jake thought this was without a doubt the best bookstore he'd ever been in. The question was, why was he here? Was it luck? Or was it part of that soft, insistent feeling that he was following a trail, a kind of force beam that had been left for him to find? He glanced at the display on a small table to his left and knew the answer. 13. It was a display of children's books. There wasn't much room on the table, so there were only about a dozen of them. Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, The Hobbit, Tom Sawyer, things like that. Jake had been attracted by a storybook obviously meant for very young children. On the bright green cover was an anthropomorphic locomotive puffing its way up a hill. Its cowcatcher, which was bright pink, wore a happy grin, and its headlight was a cheerful eye, which seemed to invite Jake Chambers to come inside and read all about it. Charlie the Choo-Choo, the title proclaimed, story and pictures by Beryl Evans. Jake's mind flashed back to his final essay, with a picture of the Amtrak train on the title page and the words Choo-Choo written over and over again inside. He grabbed the book and clutched it tightly as if it might fly away if he relaxed his grip. And as he looked down at the cover, Jake found that he did not trust the smile on Charlie the Choo-Choo's face. "You look happy, but I think that's just the mask you wear," he thought. "I don't think you're happy at all, and I don't think Charlie's your real name either." These were crazy thoughts to be having, undoubtedly crazy. But they did not feel crazy. They felt sane. They felt true. Standing next to the place where Charlie the Choo-Choo had been was a tattered paperback. The cover was quite badly torn and had been mended with scotch tape now yellow with age. The picture showed a puzzled-looking boy and girl with a forest of question marks over their heads. The title of this book was Riddledy-Dum, Brain Twisters and Puzzles for Everyone. No author was credited. Jake tucked Charlie the Choo-Choo under his arm and picked up the riddle book. He opened it at random and saw this. When is a door not a door? When it's ajar, Jake muttered. He could feel sweat popping out on his forehead, his arms, all over his body. When it's ajar... Find something, son? A mild voice inquired. Jake turned around and saw a fat guy in an open-throated white shirt standing at the end of the counter. His hands were stuffed in the pockets of his old gabardine slacks. A pair of half-glasses were pushed up on the bright dome of his bald head. Yes, Jake said feverishly. These two, are they for sale? Everything you see is for sale, the fat guy said. The building itself would be for sale if I owned it. Alas, I only lease. He held out his hand for the books, and for a moment Jake balked. Then, reluctantly, he handed them over. Part of him expected the fat guy to flee with them, and if he did, if he gave the slightest indication of trying it, Jake meant to tackle him, rip the books out of his hands, and boogie. He needed those books. Okay, let's see what you got, the fat man said. By the way, I'm Tower, Calvin Tower. He stuck out his hand. Jake's eyes widened, and he took an involuntary step backward. What? The fat guy looked at him with some interest. Calvin Tower, which word is profanity in your language, O Hyperborean wanderer? Huh? I just mean you look like someone goosed you, kid. Oh, sorry. He clasped Mr. Tower's large, soft hand, hoping the man wouldn't pursue it. The name had given him a jump, but he didn't know why. I'm Jake Chambers. Calvin Tower shook his hand. Good handle, pard. Sounds like the footloose hero in a Western novel. The guy who blows into Black Fork, Arizona, cleans up the town and then travels on. Something by Wayne D. Overholser, maybe. Except you don't look footloose, Jake. You look like you decided the day was a little too nice to spend in school. Oh, no, we finished up last Friday. Tower grinned. Uh-huh, I bet. And you've got to have these two items, huh? It's sort of funny what people have to have. Now you. I would have pegged you as a Robert Howard kind of kid from the jump, looking for a good deal on one of those nice old Donald M. Grant editions, the ones with the Roy Krenkel paintings. Dripping swords, mighty thews, and Conan the Barbarian hacking his way through the Stygian hordes. That sounds pretty good, actually. These are for my little brother. It's his birthday next week. Calvin Tower used his thumb to flip his glasses down onto his nose and had a closer look at Jake. Really? You look like an only child to me. An only child, if I ever saw one, enjoying a day of French leave as Mistress May trembles in her green gown just outside the bosky dell of June. Come again? Never mind. Spring always puts me in a William Cowperish mood. People are weird but interesting, Tex. Am I right? I guess so, Jake said cautiously. He couldn't decide if he liked this odd man or not. One of the counter browsers spun on his stool. He was holding a cup of coffee in one hand and a battered paperback copy of The Plague in the other. Quit pulling the kid's chain and sell him the books, Cal, he said. We've still got time to finish this game of chess before the end of the world if you hurry up. Hurry is antithetical to my nature, Cal said. But he opened Charlie the Choo-Choo and peered at the price penciled on the flyleaf. A fairly common book, but this copy's in unusually fine condition. Little kids usually rack the hell out of the ones they like. I should get $12 for it. Goddamn thief, the man who was reading The Plague said, and the other browser laughed. Calvin Tower paid no notice. But I can't bear to dock you that much on a day like this. $7 and it's yours, plus tax, of course. The riddle book you can have for free. Consider it my gift to a boy wise enough to saddle up and light out for the territories on the last real day of spring. Jake dug out his wallet and opened it anxiously, afraid he had left the house with only $3 or $4. He was in luck, however. He had a 5 and 3 ones. He held the money out to Tower, who folded the bills casually into one pocket and made change out of the other. Don't hurry off, Jake, Now that you're here, come on over to the counter and have a cup of coffee. Your eyes will widen with amazement as I cut Aaron Deepnose spavined old Kiev defense to ribbons. Don't you wish, said the man who was reading the plague, Aaron Deepnose, presumably. I'd like to, but I can't. There's someplace I have to be. Okay, as long as it's not back to school. Jake grinned. No, not school. That way lies madness. Tower laughed out loud and flipped his glasses up to the top of his head again. Not bad, not bad at all. Maybe the younger generation isn't going to hell after all, Aaron. What do you think? Oh, they're going to hell all right, Aaron said. This boy's just an exception to the rule. Maybe. Don't mind that cynical old fart, Calvin Tower said. Motor on, oh Hyperborean wanderer. I wish I were 10 or 11 again with a beautiful day like this ahead of me. Thanks for the books, Jake said. No problem, that's what we're here for. Come on back sometime. I'd like to. Well, you know where we are. Yes, Jake thought. Now if I only knew where I am. He stopped just outside the bookstore and flipped open the riddle book again, this time to page 1, where there was a short, uncredited introduction. Riddles are perhaps the oldest of all the games people still play today, it began. The gods and goddesses of Greek myth teased each other with riddles, and they were employed as teaching tools in ancient Rome. The Bible contains several good riddles. One of the most famous of these was told by Samson on the day he was married to Delilah. Out of the eater came forth meat, and out of the strong came forth sweetness. He asked this riddle of several young men who attended his wedding, confident that they wouldn't be able to guess the answer. The young men, however, got Delilah aside, and she whispered the answer to them. Samson was furious and had the young men put to death for cheating. In the old days, you see, riddles were taken much more seriously than they are today. By the way, the answer to Samson's riddle and all the other riddles in this book can be found in the section at the back. We only ask that you give each puzzler a fair chance before you peek. Jake turned to the back of the book, somehow knowing what he would find even before he got there. Beyond the page marked answers, there was nothing but a few torn fragments and the back cover. The section had been ripped out. He stood there for a moment, thinking. Then, on an impulse that didn't really feel like an impulse at all, Jake walked back inside the Manhattan restaurant of the mind. Calvin Tower looked up from the chessboard. Change your mind about that cup of coffee, O Hyperborean wanderer? No. I wanted to ask you if you know the answer to a riddle. Fire away, Tower invited and moved a pawn. Samson told it, the strong guy in the Bible. It goes like this. Out of the eater came forth meat, said Aaron Deepnose, swinging around again to look at Jake, and out of the strong came forth sweetness. That the one? Yeah, it is, Jake said. How'd you know? Oh, I've been around the block a time or two. Listen to this. He threw his head back and sang in a full, melodious voice. Samson and a lion got an attack, and Samson climbed up on the lion's back. Well, you've read about a lion killing men with their paws, but Samson put his hands round the lion's jaws. He rode that lion till the beast fell dead, and the bees made honey in the lion's head. Aaron winked, and then laughed at Jake's surprised expression. That answer your question, friend? Jake's eyes were wide. Wow! Good song! Where'd you hear it? Oh, Aaron knows them all, Tower said. He was hanging around Bleecker Street back before Bob Dylan knew how to blow more than open G on his honer. At least if you believe him. It's an old spiritual, Aaron said to Jake, and then to Tower. By the way, you're in check, fatso. Not for long, Tower said. He moved his bishop. Aaron promptly bagged it. Tower muttered something under his breath. To Jake it sounded suspiciously like fuckwad. So the answer is a lion, Jake said. Aaron shook his head. Only half the answer. Samson's riddle is a double, my friend. The other half of the answer is honey. Get it? Yes, I think so. Okay, now try this one. Aaron closed his eyes for a moment and then recited, "What can run but never walks, has a mouth but never talks, has a bed but never sleeps, has a head but never weeps." "Smartass," Tower growled at Aaron. Jake thought it over, then shook his head. He could have worried it longer. He found this business of riddles both fascinating and charming, but he had a strong feeling that he ought to be moving on from here, that he had other business on Second Avenue this morning. "I give up." "No, you don't," Aaron said. "That's what you do with modern riddles. But a real riddle isn't just a joke, kiddo. It's a puzzle. Turn it over in your head. If you still can't get it, make an excuse to come back another day. If you need another excuse, Fatso here does make a pretty good cup of joe." "Okay," Jake said. "Thanks. I will." But as he left, a certainty stole over him. He would never enter the Manhattan restaurant of the mind again. 15. Jake walked slowly down Second Avenue, holding his new purchases in his left hand. At first he tried to think about the riddle, what did have a bed but never slept, but little by little the question was driven from his mind by an increasing sense of anticipation. His senses seemed more acute than ever before in his life. He saw billions of coruscating sparks in the pavement, smelled 1,000 mixed aromas in every breath he took, and seemed to hear other sounds, secret sounds, within each of the sounds he heard. He wondered if this was the way dogs felt before thunderstorms or earthquakes, and felt almost sure that it was. Yet the sensation that the impending event was not bad but good, that it would balance out the terrible thing which had happened to him 3 weeks ago, continued to grow. And now, as he drew close to the place where the course would be set, that knowing in advance fell upon him once again. "A bum is going to ask me for a handout, and I'll give him the change Mr. Tower gave me. And there's a record store. The door's open to let in the fresh air, and I'll hear a Stones song playing when I pass. And I'm going to see my own reflection in a bunch of mirrors." Traffic on Second Avenue was still light. Taxis honked and wove their way amid the slower-moving cars and trucks. Spring sunshine twinkled off their windshields and bright yellow hides. While he was waiting for a light to change, Jake saw the bum on the far corner of 2nd and 52nd. He was sitting against the brick wall of a small restaurant, and as Jake approached him, he saw that the name of the restaurant was Choo Choo Mama's. "Choo Choo," Jake thought. "And that's the truth."
"Got a quarter?"
the bum asked tiredly, and Jake dropped his change from the bookstore into the bum's lap without even looking around. Now he could hear the Rolling Stones right on schedule. "I see a red door and I want to paint it black. No colors anymore, I want them to turn black." As he passed, he saw, also without surprise, that the name of the store was Tower of Power Records. Towers were selling cheap today, it seemed. Jake walked on, the street signs floating past in a kind of dream daze. Between 49th and 48th, he passed a store called Reflections of You. He turned his head and caught sight of a dozen Jakes in the mirrors, as he had known he would. A dozen boys who were small for their age. A dozen boys dressed in neat school clothes. Blue blazers, white shirts, dark red ties, gray dress pants. Piper School didn't have an official uniform, but this was as close to the unofficial one as you could get. Piper seemed long ago and far away now. Suddenly Jake realized where he was going. This knowledge rose in his mind like sweet, refreshing water from an underground spring. "It's a delicatessen," he thought. "That's what it looks like anyway. It's really something else, a doorway to another world. The world. His world. The right world." He began to run, looking ahead eagerly. The light at 47th was against him, but he ignored it, leaping from the curb and racing nimbly between the broad white lines of the crosswalk with just a perfunctory glance to the left. A plumbing van stopped short with a squeal of tires as Jake flashed in front of it.
"Hey, what are you? What are you?"
the driver yelled, but Jake ignored him. Only one more block. He began to sprint all out now. His tie fluttered behind his left shoulder. His hair had blown back from his forehead. His school loafers hammered the sidewalk. He ignored the stares, some amused, some merely curious, of the passers-by, as he had ignored the van driver's outraged shout. Up here on the corner, next to the stationery store. Here came a UPS man in dark brown fatigues, pushing a dolly loaded with packages. Jake hurdled it like a long jumper, arms up. The tail of his white shirt pulled free of his pants and flapped beneath his blazer like the hem of a slip. He came down and almost collided with a baby carriage being pushed by a young Puerto Rican woman. Jake hooked around the pram like a halfback who has spotted a hole in the line and is bound for glory. "Where's the fire, handsome?" the young woman asked, but Jake ignored her, too. He dashed past the paper patch with its window display of pens and notebooks and desk calculators. "The door!" he thought ecstatically. "I'm going to see it! And am I going to stop? No way, Jose! I'm going to go straight through it, and if it's locked, I'll flatten it right in front of me!" Then he saw what was at the corner of 2nd and 46th, and stopped after all. Skidded to a halt, in fact, on the heels of his loafers. He stood there in the middle of the sidewalk, hands clenched, his breath rasping harshly in and out of his lungs, his hair falling back onto his forehead in sweaty clumps. "No!" he almost whimpered. "No!" But his near frantic negation did not change what he saw, which was nothing at all. There was nothing to see but a short board fence and a littered, weedy lot beyond it. The building which had stood there had been demolished. Sixteen. Jake stood outside the fence without moving for almost 2 minutes, surveying the vacant lot with dull eyes. One corner of his mouth twitched randomly. He could feel his hope, his absolute certainty, draining out of him. The feeling which was replacing it was the deepest, bitterest despair he had ever known. "Just another false alarm," he thought when the shock had abated enough so he could think anything at all. "Another false alarm, blind alley, dry well. Now the voices will start up again, and when they do, I think I'm going to start screaming. And that's okay, because I'm tired of toughing this thing out. I'm tired of going crazy. If this is what going crazy is like, then I just want to hurry up and get there so somebody will take me to the hospital and give me something that'll knock me out. I give up. This is the end of the line. I'm through." But the voices did not come back. At least not yet. And as he began to think about what he was seeing, he realized that the lot wasn't completely empty after all. Standing in the middle of the trash-littered, weedy waste ground was a sign. "Mills Construction and Sombra Real Estate Associates are continuing to remake the face of Manhattan. Coming soon to this location, Turtle Bay Luxury Condominiums. Call 555-6712 for information. You will be so glad you did." Coming soon? Maybe. But Jake had his doubts. The letters on the sign were faded, and it was sagging a little. At least one graffiti artist, Bango Skank by name, had left his mark across the artist's drawing of the Turtle Bay Luxury Condominiums in bright blue spray paint. Jake wondered if the project had been postponed, or if it had maybe just gone belly up. He remembered hearing his father talking on the telephone to his business advisor not 2 weeks ago, yelling at the man to stay away from any more condo investments. "I don't care how good the tax picture looks," he nearly screamed. This was, as far as Jake could tell, his father's normal tone of voice when discussing business matters. The Coke in the desk drawer might have had something to do with that. "When they're offering a goddamn TV set just so you'll come down and look at a blueprint, something's wrong." The board fence surrounding the lot was chin-high to Jake. It had been plastered with handbills. Olivia Newton-John at Radio City, a group called G. Gordon Liddy and the Grots at a club in the East Village, a film called War of the Zombies, which had come and gone earlier that spring. No trespassing signs had also been nailed up at intervals along the fence, but most of them had been papered over by ambitious bill posters. A little way farther along, another graffito had been spray-painted on the fence, this one in what had once undoubtedly been a bright red, but which had now faded to the dusky pink of late summer roses. Jake whispered the words aloud, his eyes wide and fascinated. See the turtle of enormous girth. On his shell he holds the earth. If you want to run and play, come along the beam today. Jake supposed the source of this strange little poem, if not its meaning, was clear enough. This part of Manhattan's east side was known, after all, as Turtle Bay. But that didn't explain the goose flesh, which was now running up the center of his back in a rough stripe, or his clear sense that he had found another road sign along some fabulous hidden highway. Jake unbuttoned his shirt and stuck his two newly purchased books inside. Then he looked around, saw no one paying attention to him, and grabbed the top of the fence. He boosted himself up, swung a leg over, and dropped down on the other side. His left foot landed on a loose pile of bricks that promptly slid out from under him. His ankle buckled under his weight, and bright pain lanced up his leg. He fell with a thud and cried out in mingled hurt and surprise as more bricks dug into his rib cage like thick, rude fists. He simply lay where he was for a moment, waiting to get his breath back. He didn't think he was badly hurt, but he'd twisted his ankle, and it would probably swell. He'd be walking with a limp by the time he got home. He'd just have to grin and bear it, though. He sure didn't have cab fare. You don't really plan to go home, do you? They'll eat you alive. Well, maybe they would, and maybe they wouldn't. So far as he could see, he didn't have much choice in the matter. And that was for later. Right now, he was going to explore this lot, which had drawn him as surely as a magnet draws steel shavings. That feeling of power was still all around him, he realized, and stronger than ever. He didn't think this was just a vacant lot. Something was going on here, something big. He could feel it thrumming in the air, like loose volts escaping from the biggest power plant in the world. As he got up, Jake saw that he had actually fallen lucky. Close by was a nasty jumble of broken glass. If he'd fallen into that, he might have cut himself very badly. That used to be the show window, Jake thought. When the deli was still here, you could stand on the sidewalk and look in at all the meats and cheeses. They used to hang them on strings. He didn't know how he knew this, but he did. Knew it beyond a shadow of a doubt. He looked around thoughtfully and then walked a little farther into the lot. Near the middle, lying on the ground and half buried in a lush growth of spring weeds, was another sign. Jake knelt beside it, pulled it upright, and brushed the dirt away. The letters were faded, but he could still make them out. Tom and Jerry's Artistic Deli. Party platters are specialty. And below it, spray-painted in that same red fading to pink, was this puzzling sentence. He holds us all within his mind. This is the place, Jake thought. Oh, yes. He let the sign fall back, stood up, and walked deeper into the lot, moving slowly, looking at everything. As he moved, that sensation of power grew. Everything he saw, the weeds, the broken glass, the clumps of bricks, seemed to stand forth with a kind of exclamatory force. Even the potato chip bag seemed beautiful, and the sun had turned a discarded beer bottle into a cylinder of brown fire. Jake was very aware of his own breathing and of the sunlight falling upon everything like a weight of gold. He suddenly understood that he was standing on the edge of a great mystery, and he felt a shudder, half terror and half wonder, work through him. It's all here. Everything is still here. The weeds brushed at his pants, burdock stuck to his socks. The breeze blew a ringding wrapper in front of him. The sun reflected off it, and for a moment the wrapper was filled with a beautiful, terrible inner glow. Everything is still here, he repeated to himself, unaware that his face was filling with its own inner glow. Everything. He was hearing a sound. Had been hearing it ever since he entered the lot, in fact. It was a wonderful, high humming, inexpressibly lonely and inexpressibly lovely. It might have been the sound of a high wind on a deserted plain, except it was alive. It was, he thought, the sound of a thousand voices singing some great open chord. He looked down and realized there were faces in the tangled weeds and low bushes and heaps of bricks. Faces! "What are you?" Jake whispered. "Who are you?" There was no answer, but he seemed to hear beneath the choir the sound of hoofbeats on the dusty earth and gunfire and angels calling hosannas from the shadows. The faces in the wreckage seemed to turn as he passed. They seemed to follow his progress, but no evil intent did they bear. He could see 46th Street and the edge of the UN building on the other side of First Avenue, but the buildings did not matter. New York did not matter. It had become as pale as window glass. The humming grew. Now it was not a thousand voices, but a million, an open funnel of voices rising from the deepest well of the universe. He caught names in that group voice, but could not have said what they were. One might have been Martin, one might have been Cuthbert, another might have been Roland. Roland of Gilead. There were names. There was a babble of conversation that might have been 10,000 entwined stories, but above all was that gorgeous, swelling hum, a vibration that wanted to fill his head with bright, white light. It was, Jake realized, with a joy so overwhelming that it threatened to burst him to pieces, the voice of yes, the voice of white, the voice of always. It was a great chorus of affirmation, and it sang in the empty lot. It sang for him. Then, lying in a cluster of scrubby burdock plants, Jake saw the key. And beyond that, the rose. XVII. His legs betrayed him, and he fell to his knees. He was vaguely aware that he was weeping, even more vaguely aware that he had wet his pants a little. He crawled forward on his knees and reached toward the key lying in the snarl of burdocks. Its simple shape was one he seemed to have seen in his dreams. He thought, the little S-shape at the end, that's the secret. As he closed his hand around the key, the voices rose in a harmonic shout of triumph. Jake's own cry was lost in the voice of that choir. He saw the key flash white within his fingers and felt a tremendous jolt of power run up his arm. It was as if he had grasped a live, high-tension wire, but there was no pain. He opened Charlie the Choo-Choo and put the key inside. Then his eyes fixed upon the rose again, and he realized that it was the real key, the key to everything. He crawled toward it, his face a flaming corona of light, his eyes blazing wells of blue fire. The rose was growing from a clump of alien purple grass. As Jake neared this clump of alien grass, the rose began to open before his eyes. It disclosed a dark scarlet furnace, petal upon secret petal, each burning with its own secret fury. He had never seen anything so intensely and utterly alive in his whole life. And now, as he stretched one grimy hand out toward this wonder, the voices began to sing his own name, and deadly fear began to steal in toward the center of his heart. It was as cold as ice and as heavy as stone. There was something wrong. He could feel a pulsing discord, like a deep and ugly scratch across some priceless work of art, or a deadly fever smoldering beneath the chilly skin of an invalid's brow. It was something like a worm, an invading worm, and a shape, one which lurks just beyond the next turn of the road. Then the heart of the rose opened for him, exposing a yellow dazzle of light, and all thought was swept away on a wave of wonder. Jake thought for a moment that what he was seeing was only pollen, which had been invested with the supernatural glow which lived at the heart of every object in this deserted clearing. He thought it even though he had never heard of pollen within a rose. He leaned closer and saw that the concentrated circle of blazing yellow was not pollen at all. It was a sun. A vast forge burning at the center of this rose growing in the purple grass. The fear returned, only now it had become outright terror. It's right, he thought, everything here is right, but it could go wrong, has started going wrong already, I think. I'm being allowed to feel as much of that wrongness as I can bear. But what is it? And what can I do? It was something like a worm. He could feel it beating like a sick and dirty heart, warring with the serene beauty of the rose, screaming harsh profanities against the choir of voices which had so soothed and lifted him. He leaned closer to the rose and saw that its core was not just one sun, but many, perhaps all suns, contained within a ferocious yet fragile shell. But it's wrong. It's all in danger. Knowing it would almost surely mean his death to touch that glowing microcosm, but helpless to stop himself, Jake reached forward. There was no curiosity or terror in this gesture, only a great, inarticulate need to protect the rose. When he came back to himself, he was at first only aware that a great deal of time had passed, and his head hurt like hell. What happened? Was I mugged? He rolled over and sat up. Another blast of pain went through his head. He raised a hand to his left temple, and his fingers came away sticky with blood. He looked down and saw a brick poking out of the weeds. Its rounded corner was too red. If it had been sharp, I'd probably be dead or in a coma. He looked at his wrist and was surprised to find he was still wearing his watch. It was a Seiko, not terribly expensive, but in this city you didn't snooze in vacant lots without losing your stuff. Expensive or not, someone would be more than happy to relieve you of it. This time he had been lucky, it seemed. It was 4:15 in the afternoon. He had been lying here, dead to the world, for at least 5 hours. His father probably had the cops out looking for him by now, but that didn't seem to matter much. It seemed to Jake that he had walked out of Piper School about 1,000 years ago. Jake walked half the distance to the fence between the vacant lot and the Second Avenue sidewalk, then stopped. What exactly had happened to him? Little by little, the memories came back. Hopping the fence, slipping and twisting his ankle. He reached down, touched it, and winced. Yes, that much had happened, all right. Then what? Something magical. He groped for that something like an old man groping his way across a shadowy room. Everything had been full of its own light. Everything, even the empty wrappers and discarded beer bottles. There had been voices. They had been singing and telling thousands of overlapping stories. And faces, he muttered. This memory made him look around apprehensively. He saw no faces. The piles of bricks were just piles of bricks, and the tangles of weeds were just tangles of weeds. There were no faces, but they were here. It wasn't your imagination. He believed that. He couldn't capture the essence of the memory, its quality of beauty and transcendence, but it seemed perfectly real. It was just that his memory of those moments before he had passed out seemed like photographs taken on the best day of your life. You can remember what that day was like, sort of, anyway, but the pictures are flat and almost powerless. Jake looked around the desolate lot, now filling up with the violet shadows of late afternoon, and thought, I want you back. God, I want you back the way you were. Then he saw the rose, growing in its clump of purple grass, very close to the place where he had fallen. His heart leaped into his throat. Jake blundered back toward it, unmindful of the beats of pain each step sent up from his ankle. He dropped to his knees in front of it like a worshiper at an altar. He leaned forward, eyes wide. "It's just a rose. Just a rose, after all. And the grass..." The grass wasn't purple after all, he saw. There were splatters of purple on the blades, yes, but the color beneath was a perfectly normal green. He looked a little further and saw splashes of blue on another clump of weeds. To his right, a straggling burdock bush bore traces of both red and yellow. And beyond the burdocks was a little pile of discarded paint cans. "Glidden spread satin," the label said. That's all it was. Just splatters of paint. Only with your head all messed up the way it was, you thought you were seeing... That was bullshit. He knew what he had seen then and what he was seeing now. "Camouflage," he whispered. "It was all right here. Everything was. And it still is." Now that his head was clearing, he could again feel the steady, harmonic power that this place held. The choir was still here, its voice just as musical, although now dim and distant. He looked at a pile of bricks and old broken chunks of plaster and saw a barely discernible face hiding within it. It was the face of a woman with a scar on her forehead. "Allie?" Jake murmured. "Isn't your name Allie?" There was no answer. The face was gone. He was only looking at an unlovely pile of bricks and plaster again. He looked back at the rose. It was, he saw, not the dark red that lives at the heart of a blazing furnace, but a dusty, mottled pink. It was very beautiful, but not perfect. Some of the petals had curled back. The outer edges of these were brown and dead. It wasn't the sort of cultivated flower he had seen in florist shops. He supposed it was a wild rose. "You're very beautiful," he said, and once more stretched his hand out to touch it. Although there was no breeze, the rose nodded toward him. For just a moment, the pads of his fingers touched its surface, smooth and velvety and marvelously alive, and all around him the voice of the choir seemed to swell. "Are you sick, Rose?" There was no answer, of course. When his fingers left the faded pink bowl of the flower, it nodded back to its original position, growing out of the paint-splattered weeds in its quiet, forgotten splendor. "Do roses bloom at this time of year?" Jake wondered. "Wild ones? Why would a wild rose grow in a vacant lot anyway? And if there's one, how come there aren't more?" He remained on his hands and knees a little longer, then realized he could stay here looking at the rose for the rest of the afternoon, or maybe the rest of his life, and not come any closer to solving its mystery. He had seen it plain for a moment, as he had seen everything else in this forgotten, trash-littered corner of the city. He had seen it with its mask off and its camouflage tossed aside. He wanted to see that again, but wanting would not make it so. It was time to go home. He saw the two books he'd bought at the Manhattan Restaurant of the Mind lying nearby. As he picked them up, a bright silver object slipped from the pages of Charlie the Choo-Choo and fell into a scruffy patch of weeds. Jake bent, favoring his hurt ankle, and picked it up. As he did so, the choir seemed to sigh and swell, then fell back to its almost inaudible hum. "So that part was real, too," he murmured. He ran the ball of his thumb over the blunt, protruding points of the key and into those primitive V-shaped notches. He sent it skating over the mild S-curves at the end of the third notch. Then he tucked it deep into the right front pocket of his pants and began to limp back toward the fence. He had reached it and was preparing to scramble over the top when a terrible thought suddenly seized his mind. "The rose! What if somebody comes in here and picks it?" A little moan of horror escaped him. He turned back, and after a moment his eyes picked it out, although it was deep in the shadow of a neighboring building now, a tiny pink shape in the dimness, vulnerable, beautiful, and alone. "I can't leave it," I have to guard it. But a voice spoke up in his mind, a voice that was surely that of the man he had met at the way station in that strange other life. No one will pick it, nor will any vandal crush it beneath his heel because his dull eyes cannot abide the sight of its beauty. That is not the danger. It can protect itself from such things as those. A sense of deep relief swept through Jake. "Can I come here again and look at it?" he asked the phantom voice. "When I'm low, or if the voices come back and start their argument again, can I come back and look at it and have some peace?" The voice did not answer, and after a few moments of listening, Jake decided it was gone. He tucked Charlie the Choo-Choo and Riddledy Dum into the waistband of his pants, which he saw were streaked with dirt and dotted with clinging burdocks, and then grabbed the board fence. He boosted himself up, swung over the top, and dropped onto the sidewalk of Second Avenue again, being careful to land on his good foot. Traffic on the avenue, both pedestrian and vehicular, was much heavier now as people made their way home for the night. A few passers-by looked at the dirty boy in the torn blazer and untucked flapping shirt as he jumped awkwardly down from the fence, but not many. New Yorkers are used to the sight of people doing peculiar things. He stood there a moment, feeling a sense of loss, and realizing something else as well. The arguing voices were still absent. That, at least, was something. He glanced at the board fence, and the verse of spray-painted doggerel seemed to leap out at him, perhaps because the paint was the same color as the rose. "See the turtle of enormous girth," Jake muttered. "On his shell he holds the earth." He shivered. "What a day, boy!" He turned and began to limp slowly in the direction of home. The doorman must have buzzed up as soon as Jake entered the lobby, because his father was standing outside the elevator when it opened on the fifth floor. Elmer Chambers was wearing faded jeans and cowboy boots that improved his 5'10 to a rootin' tootin' 6 feet. His black crew-cut hair bolted up from his head. For as long as Jake could remember, his father had looked like a man who had just suffered some tremendous, galvanizing shock. As soon as Jake stepped out of the elevator, Chambers seized him by the arm. "Look at you!" His father's eyes flicked up and down, taking in Jake's dirty face and hands, the blood drying on his cheek and temple, the dusty pants, the torn blazer, and the burdock that clung to his tie like some peculiar clip. "Get in here! Where the hell have you been? Your mother's just about off her fucking gourd!" Without giving Jake a chance to answer, he dragged him through the apartment door. Jake saw Greta Shaw standing in the archway between the dining room and the kitchen. She gave him a look of guarded sympathy, then disappeared before the eyes of the mister could chance upon her. Jake's mother was sitting in her rocker. She got to her feet when she saw Jake, but she did not leap to her feet. Neither did she pelt across to the foyer so she could cover him with kisses and invective. As she came toward him, Jake assessed her eyes and guessed she'd had at least 3 Valiums since noon, maybe 4. Both of his parents were firm believers in better living through chemistry. "You're bleeding. Where have you been?" She made this inquiry in her cultured Vassar voice, pronouncing bean so it rhymed with seen. She might have been greeting an acquaintance who had been involved in a minor traffic accident. "Out," he said. His father gave him a rough shake. Jake wasn't prepared for it. He stumbled and came down on his bad ankle. The pain flared again, and he was suddenly furious. Jake didn't think his father was pissed because he had disappeared from school, leaving only his mad composition behind. His father was pissed because Jake had had the temerity to fuck up his own precious schedule. To this point in his life, Jake had been aware of only 3 feelings about his father: puzzlement, fear, and a species of weak, confused love. Now a 4th and 5th surfaced. One was anger, the other was disgust. Mixed in with these unpleasant feelings was that sense of homesickness. It was the largest thing inside him right now, weaving through everything else like smoke. He looked at his father's flushed cheeks and screaming haircut and wished he was back in the vacant lot, looking at the rows and listening to the choir. "This is not my place," he thought. "Not anymore. I have work to do. If only I knew what it was." "Let go of me," he said.